Welcome to Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. The future of the Florida Supreme Court lies in the balance as three justices will be replaced in January of 2019. But incredibly, it's still up in the air. Who will appoint those new justices? Outgoing Governor Rick Scott or his successor? We'll talk about that in the first half of the show with a constitutional law professor. And I'd like to hear your questions. Here's the number to call, 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. We'll also check in on the debate about a controversial Confederate monument in Lakeland. So again, 813-239-9663 if you'd like to talk about those two issues. Louis Varelli is Stetson University Professor of Law and an expert in constitutional administrative law in the federal courts. Varelli is the author of Disqualifying the High Court, Supreme Court Recusal, and the Constitution. I want to welcome you to WMNF's Midpoint, Professor Varelli.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's begin with, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, there's a term limit for justices on Florida's Supreme Court. That means that nearly half of them are forced to step down 13 months from now. So tell us about why they have to step down.
Well, there's a constitutional provision in Florida stating that after a justice turns 70, they're no longer allowed to run in a retention election or run in an election to retain their position.
And that three of them are turning 70 or have turned 70, and so they are not able to run again. But what does the Constitution say about who shall replace those people?
Well, that's, of course, an interesting question. The Constitution sets out some provisions to explain how that vacancy based on the unavailability of retention occurs. The real question here, of course, is timing. So the relevant constitutional provisions seem to indicate that the justice's term will end on the Tuesday after the first Monday in January. So then we're talking about 2019 here. So that would be January 8th, 2019. And then the question is, does Governor Scott have the authority to appoint justices, new justices, to fill that vacancy because his term expires at the end of the day on the 7th, or at least could expire on the end of the day of the 7th? His last full day in office will be January 7th. There's a question as to whether or not his authority as governor would carry over to the 8th, depending on when the oath of office is administered to the new governor.
Has this ever happened before, where you've had essentially two different governors on the same day at different times of the day, on the day that Supreme Court justices are supposed to be replaced?
It hasn't happened in a contentious way. So the reason this is coming before the Florida Supreme Court is that there's a lawsuit suggesting or indicating, filed by the League of Women Voters and others, that there could very well be a, as they call it, a constitutional crisis, a conflict about who is the rightfully appointed Supreme Court justice. And of course, we saw this, at least a version of this, at the federal level at the end of President Obama's term, with Judge Garland being nominated to the court and the Senate not acting. Those things are not directly analogous, but it's the kind of crisis that, or the kind of conflict that we generally like to avoid, and in the past governors have. But there's a strong possibility in this case that we would have a scenario where Governor Scott appointed three new justices while he was still in office. The new governor taking office on that Tuesday, the 8th sometime, would appoint three different people, and we'd have a debate on our hands as to who the bona fide appointees were.
And you say not in a contentious way. This has not happened before. I think it was when Lawton Child's term was about to end and Governor Jeb Bush had been elected governor. Of course, Lawton Child's died before his term ended. But the two of them got together and decided who the new justices would be. Is that right?
Right. And of course, we don't have that luxury now because we don't know who the new governor will be. And that's always a possibility. So that, of course, could happen going up until January 7th of 2019. This is something that governors could, an outgoing governor and an incoming governor, could resolve amicably. But at this point, we're too far out to know if that's possible because we don't know who the players would be. And the possibility of a conflict is, depending on your point of view, at least potentially real.
So is it too early then to worry about it? Why have a lawsuit to settle everything? And, you know, it could happen where a protege of Rick Scott is elected governor and everything's peachy keen. And is it too early to be thinking about this?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that's a matter of debate. I think the arguments are that because Governor Scott has been so clear that he intends to do this even in the face of opposition. So his public statements have said that he will appoint three justices at midnight on the latter, the morning of his last day in office, regardless of who the new governor is. That suggests that in the event a conflict, the facts precipitating a conflict occurred, Governor Scott wouldn't attempt to avoid them. Just taking his statements at face value. If he were to say something like, well, we'll have to cross that bridge when we get there, and I will be open to working with my successor on reaching an amicable solution, I think you'd have less of a claim that this is the kind of thing that the courts need to resolve now. If there's a pending conflict, then the sooner the better, in the sense that this is going to take a long time and already has. And we know when the conflict will arise. If it does, it'll arise on January 8th, 2019.
Our guest is Louis Varelli. He's a Stetson University professor of law and expert in constitutional administrative law in the federal courts. So I guess one of the things that the Florida Supreme Court will be looking at is exactly when, you know, the timing of when does a governor's term end and when does a governor's term start, and what's the timing of appointing the justices. Do we have any guidance in the Constitution about those?
Well, not very much. So the governor's term certainly runs through the end of the first Monday in January after the election. The parties don't dispute that. There is a dispute as to whether we have to wait on that Tuesday until an oath of office is administered. But there is no, as far as I understand the party's positions from reading the documents in the case and following it, I don't think there's a dispute as to the fact that the new governor could be sworn in right at midnight on January 8th, so that if the oath of office were the triggering event, there's certainly nothing in the Constitution that says what time of day that oath has to be administered. By contrast, the U.S. Constitution says noon, so we know exactly when, to the minute, our transfer of power occurs at the federal level, and that's right at the stroke of noon on Inauguration Day.
Last week, the state Supreme Court ruled on a recusal issue in this very case. Governor Scott had petitioned the court for Justice Perriente. She's one of the three who's going to have to be retiring. He petitioned that she be removed from this case because of things she has said about the case. So what did she say, and why did Rick Scott feel that warranted her recusal?
Well, and there's some debate about what she said. There was a conversation on an open mic in court between two of the justices, and the conversation seemed to indicate personal feelings by the justices about potential appointees to the court. The argument there, of course, is that Justice Perriente, but the argument from the governor is that Justice Perriente is biased in a way that is specific to this case, and that would render her unable to issue a sort of a neutral, impartial judgment. Interestingly, she was chatting with another justice about this who's not been part of the recusal motion, a justice from a appointed by a governor of a different party. And the court denied the motion for recusal sort of in a cursory manner with a simple one-sentence denial of the governor's motion.
And Governor Scott was, I guess, nervous about what she had said, because if you take his way of looking at things, he says that that Barbara Perriente brought this sheet of paper with a list of who is on the Judicial Nominating Commission, who will pick some of the people who might become the future judges. And she pointed at one of the names, Jesse Panuccio, who was a Scott former economic advisor. And she said, crazy, or I might be getting part of this wrong. This is what Scott says in these documents. And that LaBarga then said, Izzy Reyes is on there, he'll listen to me. So it does appear that these justices who will be affected by the case, presumably, are possibly forming an opinion about the, you know, some of the facts of the case. Yet they as a group, the seven members of the Supreme Court, simply put out a one-sentence statement that said, no, we're not going to ask Barbara Perriente to recuse herself or be removed from this case.
Right, and this is the kind of issue that I spend much of my time thinking about at the federal level. The question here is the Supreme Court materially different in the way we think about recusal? And of course, recusal is the removing of a judge or justice from a single case for reasons particular to that case. Now, procedurally, the way we do recusal in the U.S., this case was very routine. Judges and justices make the initial determination of whether they should recuse themselves based on their own understanding of the facts at every level of the judicial system in every state in the union. So that's not unusual. The whole court issuing a determination about the motion is also, I suppose, not unusual, arguably unnecessary because it was a motion to recuse a single justice. But either way, the court defending its own justice or upholding the decision of its own justice not to recuse is also not unusual. Some of the considerations that I think are occasionally lost in this area, and this is a large part of what I argue in my book, is that Supreme Courts are inherently different because of the finality of their decisions. In this case, and remember, the Supreme Court justices would not have any authority to dictate the names that Justice Scott chooses from, not directly, right? So the case before them that Governor Scott sought to recuse Justice Perriente from involves the power of the governor to make an appointment on a given day and in a given time. It has nothing to do with the individuals who may be appointed. So that is not an issue in the case before the court. So it's not directly on point in that regard. But we also have an odd-numbered court. We have seven justices. By having one justice recuse, of course, we have an even-numbered court, which could lead to a tie. And that's something that the Supreme Court of the United States is very sensitive about when it makes recusal decisions. Supreme Court justices recuse frequently, but they do so, at least in my view, with an understanding that their decision to recuse has ethical implications, which of course it does, but also affects the makeup of the court, which changes the way that a case could be decided. And you can imagine how unsatisfying and potentially problematic a tie vote in a case about the authority to appoint Supreme Court justices could be to the state of Florida. And that's something, at least in my view, that Supreme Court justices should consider when they're deciding whether to recuse.
So that could be a consideration. So ultimately, when they made that decision that they were not going to ask Barbara Perriente to recuse herself, do you think that, in your legal opinion, that that was the right decision?
I do, and I've been consistent about this in all manner of context, so I don't think this case is unusual in that regard. First of all, you have two justices having a conversation together. Only one was asked to recuse, and it doesn't seem to me any more or less prejudicial to have a justice say something to the effect of, Izzy Reyes is on there, he'll listen to me. Now, I don't know what Justice LaBarga said, and I'm not being critical of the sentence, but it doesn't strike me as necessarily any different, at least for a case like this, than Justice Perriente's sentence. Both justices are interested, as any member of the legal community would be, in the names or the qualifications of the future appointees. They are not being asked to decide that in this case. They're being asked to decide about the governor's authority to make appointments in a given time frame. So to the extent that they're both interested in the process, that should be no surprise. They did not say these things publicly, or at least intentionally so. There was a hot mic and they were caught on it. That's unfortunate, but that has happened before. The real question is perception. Right? Does this create a perception of partiality among the public that damages the court's reputation or integrity? Again, in my view, not unduly so. I don't think it's reasonable to assume that the justices have no views as to individual appointees for any office. Justice Scalia said as much in a Supreme Court decision involving judicial elections and publics and bias decades ago, when he said that we should expect our justices to have opinions on legal issues, just not the specific facts of the case. Well, the facts of this case are about timing. Not about individual names. So I don't think, in my opinion, this would be cause for recusal from either justice having the conversation. And the court was unanimous and clear about that.
Our guest is Louis Farrelly. He's a law professor at Stetson University College of Law, an expert in constitutional administrative law and the federal courts. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. It's 12:20 in the afternoon, and you can call in with your question or comment as well. 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. We're talking about the Florida Supreme Court and who will appoint the next three justices in January of 2019, just 13 months from now. And politics, has to play somewhat of an issue here, because the three outgoing justices tend to lean more liberal than the rest of the court in general. So how does politics, I guess, play in the reason there's a controversy going on right now?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, and as politics is often construed as a dirty word these days, I want to make one pitch for the fact that it isn't in this case. Politics is, at least with a small p, is designed to be part of this process, in that an elected official is responsible for choosing nominees and appointees to the highest court in the state. Once those folks are on the court, they are effectively unaccountable by design. They are not removable except for impeachment until they face a retention election. In the federal courts, of course, they're never accountable for their office other than impeachment. So we expect a governor and an appointing official to take politics into consideration, or to at least be engaged in a political act, meaning the population, the voters, are expected to judge their performance in office, at least in part, on who they choose. And we see that in election after election at the federal level and at the state level. So I think that's wholly appropriate. I mean, it's interesting for folks who are sympathetic, and I'm not among them, but for folks who are sympathetic to Senator McConnell's arguments about not holding a vote on Judge Garland when President Obama nominated him to the Supreme Court nearly a year before he was set to leave office, and waiting for the folks who are sympathetic to Senator McConnell's argument that we need to wait for a new president to appoint a justice, I mean, that argument applies in spades here, because it would be waiting a matter of minutes for the new governor to make this appointment. I mean, even under the most generous construction of the time frame, we're talking about a matter of potential minutes or seconds between the end of the new governor's term and the potential appointment by outgoing Governor Scott. So if we think that elections should lead to appointments, and we often do, this one, I think, is a good example of that. There's a good political argument, or a good sort of separation of powers Democratic theory argument, that says the new governor should appoint justices to fill the vacancies, especially because they arise at exactly the same time. Those offices become open at exactly the same time, potentially, that the governor takes office.
And one of our listeners points out, Eileen in Hudson says, you know, one of the differences between the Merrick Garland example is that there hadn't even been an election yet, that we didn't know who the next president would be yet. There still was the Congress was not having a vote or hearings on Merrick Garland. So that's one of the major differences as well in these two examples.
Well, yeah, there's no question about that. And I actually think that Senator McConnell did in the Garland case is far harder to defend constitutionally than even Governor Scott's position here, which I think is a sensible or a good faith argument. I think because of the way the timing works, it may be a moot point if the new governor is sworn in on midnight on the 8th anyway. But I think the Merrick Garland case is harder to understand or to defend as a constitutional matter to not hold a vote at all.
And Chip in Tampa writes, does the spirit of the law not come into play? It makes no sense for an outgoing governor to choose justices the day before leaving office. You've kind of addressed that, but how would you answer Chip?
Well, I think in a big picture democratic government way, he's absolutely right. Right. And we want our appointing officials to be accountable for their choice. And a governor who is leaving office seconds after making that appointment is by definition unaccountable. That doesn't mean that Governor Scott wouldn't have the authority on noon of the 7th, right, if a vacancy occurred. So if there was a position to be filled and he was still unquestionably the governor of Florida, then of course he has that power. So transitions of power are often tricky. Even the U.S. Constitution, which says noon, doesn't articulate whether it's the first second of the minute of noon or the last second of the minute of noon, and I don't want to start that fight on a national scale. But time is a tricky thing. And transfers of power have to be abrupt. There can only be one governor of Florida, so we need to determine when that transition has taken place. But in terms of how this is supposed to work, or the theory behind it, of course, the person who is appointing justices should be the governor of Florida going forward, if there's some sort of dispute about who gets that authority. And there's a strong argument from political theory that says that's right.
And going back to recusal for a second, what is there an argument then that maybe the three of the justices, the three who are retiring, are really so involved in the outcome of this case that they might consider recusal?
That's interesting, right? So maybe, I think the actual opposite argument would be more compelling, which is the four justices who are going to have to work with the new justices may be even more interested. I mean, I don't know that as a personal matter among the justices at all, but as a theoretical matter, you could say, well, the three people who are leaving have less at stake than the four people who are staying. And that's often the problem with accusations is too strong a word, with allegations or concerns about judicial partiality, that we really are trying to get in the minds of those justices. I think it's fair to say that all seven justices of the Supreme Court of Florida are politically and legally engaged citizens, in addition to being our most important jurists, and of course care about who those choices are. This decision is a sort of a less interesting, politically at least, decision, because it really deals with interpreting the Constitution to understand when the transfer of power takes place. And that is an important question, and the Florida Constitution is not terribly clear about that. It says that everybody, people assuming public office have to take an oath, but it doesn't give a time for the oath. And there's precedent for administering the oath on midnight of the first day of the new term. So questions like that, I think, are more suited for judicial consideration than, say, of course, picking the individuals, which the justices are not being asked to do.
Well, I think we've made a pretty thorough investigation of all the facts of this case, but maybe what I'd like you to do as my last question is kind of put on your prognosticator hat, and how do you think this might play out?
Well, that is my least comfortable hat, just to preface it that way. Let's put it this way. I am most persuaded by the argument that the transfer of power from one governor to the other is the easiest thing to understand here. So that the transfer of power from one governor to the other, at minimum, takes place when an oath is administered. And there doesn't seem to be any reason to believe that the new governor on Tuesday, January 8th, couldn't take their oath of office at midnight on that day, such that even the most sort of expansive view of Governor Scott's appointment power doesn't carry it past the swearing in of the new governor. And similarly, the most limited view of the justices' terms gets them at least until midnight between the 7th and the 8th. So I think if a new governor were inclined to set up a scenario where the facts would favor them making the new appointments, they would be able to do that. And I think that may be the most important thing here.
And based on what we know about the Florida Supreme Court and the justices and how they voted in the past, does that seem like something that they might go along with?
That's an even more difficult question. I'm loath to predict too carefully, particularly because the court is relatively evenly divided, and this is a very difficult question. I think they will all try to find, if they decide the case on the merits, and there are a number of procedural questions we didn't have time or inclination to discuss, but if they decide to even decide the case on the merits, then I think they're going to try to find the narrowest resolution, the resolution that is most closely justified by the text so as not to interfere unduly in the process.
And I know I said that was my last question, but that opens up another question for me, and that would be, isn't there motivation? Wouldn't there be some sort of reason that the justices would kind of want to settle this forever? And when you said narrow, it makes me think that maybe it would only apply to this time, or are you talking about something that if this ever came up again, it would be essentially settled?
I was thinking more of a sort of a safe, for lack of a better word, a conservative, and I don't mean that politically, a conservative reading of the Constitution that would say, well, at minimum, the new term for the new justices starts sometime on the 8th. The governor's authority changes power at minimum when the new oath is administered. That oath can be administered at any time on that Tuesday, and let the incoming governor decide if they want to take the oath at a time that would most clearly empower them to make the choice, to to appoint the new justices. So leaving open the more flexibility with the new governor to sort of control their own destiny by saying you can take that oath anytime you want on the 8th, and the new justices' terms, or the old justices' terms, the outgoing justices' terms, at minimum go through the full day on Monday the 7th, so that by taking the oath at midnight, the new governor could effectively solve the problem. Something like that, and I'm not suggesting that I know that that will happen or even what the odds of that happening are, but something like that would be a relatively conservative, and again, by conservative, I mean limited, reading of the Florida Constitution that would still leave a fair amount of authority and discretion in the governor's chair.
All right. Well, we'll be following this case closely over the next 13 months, unless it's resolved sooner. But thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint, Professor Varelli.
I appreciate you having me.
Well, thanks so much. Louis Varelli is a Stetson University professor of law. He's an expert in constitutional administrative law and the federal courts. If you'd like to join this conversation, give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. We're going to get back to your calls in just a minute after this break. We also are going to hear a little bit from the city of Lakeland. The city commission is deciding on a controversial statue of a Confederate soldier in Munn Park, and we'll hear some of the public comment from that right after this music break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan. It's 12:33 in the afternoon. You're listening to 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. We're going to listen to a comment that was left by a listener after our last show. We hosted a live debate with three of the candidates running in a special election for Florida House District 58 in parts of Hillsborough County. This caller wanted to challenge the candidate from the Libertarian Party of Florida.
This is Mike in Tampa. I just want to make a comment about today's show. For a Libertarian Party candidate, I wanted to ask him about the party stance on race. Martin Luther King said, any country that spends more money on weapons of war than on programs to social uplift is approaching spiritual death. The Libertarian Party support the government not being involved in any type of social welfare program, and white supremacists see themselves as superior to people of the races. I think libertarians see themselves as superior to people who are disabled, impaired, or otherwise can't work a full-time job, and they have the same complex. So I want to ask the libertarian candidate about if they see themselves superior in that way, and it would not a party like that naturally attract racist elements.
Well, that was a listener commenting about our last show, which you can watch on our website. It's WMNF.org/news. Later on in the broadcast, I'll give out the number for you to leave a voicemail. You can always listen to previous shows, comment on the stories on our website, or join in the conversation on Twitter or Facebook at WMNF News. We're going to turn now to Lakeland and a controversial statue of a Confederate soldier in Munn Park. The Lakeland City Commission is voting today on whether to keep the statue and add additional monuments in the park and the rest of the city. We're going to listen to a little bit of this morning's public comments and then take your calls. Here's the number, 813-239-9663. Do you live in Lakeland? What would you have to say about this monument? Here's a couple of four or five listener public comments from this morning's Lakeland City Commission meeting.
It must not be forgotten that the army which the Stone Soldier stood for and killed men who died for the United States of America and the freedom for which it stands. We are neither Northerners or Southerners anymore. We are all Americans. We should strive to present Lakeland to those coming here as a great American city. As my children tell me on this matter, and the young people despise this monument. It is never the wrong time to do the right thing. Let's get Lakeland on the right side of history and present her in her bright light of virtue, which is the USA. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Panzer. David, I'm a number four, David McAllister.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is David McAllister. I live in Hillsborough County. I'm on the Hillsborough County Veterans Park Committee and the Hillsborough Diversity Advisory Council. I'm here to speak about keeping the monument in Munn Park. It's about the fourth or fifth time I've been here, and to show you that there is interest outside of Lakeland for what you're doing, I've been here at least twice with H.K. Edgerton. You remember him. He was the past president of the NAACP in North Carolina. He wrote an open letter to the mayor and commission and the people of Lakeland, and in it he says, "I regret I cannot be with you in person at your December 4th meeting. I'm sick and tired of all the whining and complaining about all things Confederate. The most appropriate place for a memorial to our Southern veterans is right where it is and has been for over 100 years. It is poppycock," that's his word, "poppycock to claim that that memorial put there by those ladies generations ago was intended to intimidate anyone. No, it was a loving tribute not only for fathers and husbands and brothers and sons who fought and died of all colors. The soldier on top of that monument isn't white. He isn't black. He is gray. That monument is colorblind, and it represents Holt Collier, Mack Lee, and the tens of thousands of African-American Southerners, many known only to God, who stood shoulder to shoulder with their white families and neighbors when war came against them." He goes on. He cites polls done by Save Southern Heritage, which were done by Gravis Polling, a legitimate scientific polling outfit. One was done specifically for Lakeland. One was done for Florida statewide, and others for Hillsborough, Gainesville, Hollywood, Pensacola. There's no time for the details, but they all show the majority of the people want to keep their monuments. As we prayed, there were more for them than against them. The take them down folks don't take polls because they know they don't have the people with them. It takes a little longer for this issue to filter into the political system, but in two elections recently, the pro-monument candidate won. Only a few people can come here today on Monday morning, but more people vote. And you shouldn't just consider a nose count of today's speakers. Consider how the citizens feel. This shouldn't be who can bully and threaten and whine and complain about negatives. Be positive. Munn Park was designed to be a civic asset, and it still is, with the Confederate monument to local veterans. We all saw how Lakeland appreciates history, and that includes the iconic Confederate monument. Keep Munn Park as Munn Park. Be for inclusion, not resentment. Americans build monuments. We don't remove them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McAllister.
My name is Kevin Caden, and I'm from unincorporated Polk County. I do a lot of running, and one of my routes takes me past not one, but two homes flying the Confederate flag. And I always wonder, as I pass them, are they constitutional scholars, states' rights advocates, Civil War aficionados, perhaps a descendant of a Confederate soldier? Maybe they're just rebels, with or without a cause. But I've got to wonder, are they racists, white supremacists, a member of the KKK? And I've got to admit, I really don't know. But I understand that this, thankfully, is America, and they have the right to think whatever they want. Mayor Whig states that for him, it is heritage, not hate. I have absolutely no reason to doubt him. He's an honest man with the utmost integrity. Mr. Wahey wrote that to him, it stands for valor. Others say it's the romantic Southern lifestyle. That's the problem. It means different things to different people. But I say, if you believe it wasn't fundamentally about slavery, you're fooling yourself. You can't believe anything else if you read the Mississippi Letter of Secession. Some say the statue's been in Munn Park for almost 110 years. It should stay at least another 110. I use the same facts and say, since it's been put there, there have been two world wars. I haven't forgotten about the Korean War, then Vietnam, the Persian Gulf War, intervention to stop the genocide in Bosnia, and now the War on Terror. And I look and I wonder, why is there a memorial of any type in Munn Park? which is the centerpiece of Lakeland and should be a place for an uplifting enjoyment for people. It just doesn't seem to be the right place for a history lesson. And I understand that there is at least one person so oblivious to history that she would equate a statue remembering those who picked up a gun to engage in a life or death struggle to preserve slavery with a memorial to victims of the Holocaust. And yes, Commissioner Yates and those as oblivious as her are the reasons why the statue can't just be turned to concrete dust. Long ago, there was an ad campaign, ironically for a camera called The Rebel, which said, image is everything. And those who didn't understand the pun protested, not understanding that for a camera, image is everything. Lakeland is much more than image, but leaving the statue in Munn Park diverts people from understanding the substance of Lakeland. So yes, it should be moved. A perfect location is on the southeast corner of Maine and Massachusetts. A beautiful location, just a few hundred feet from where it is now. The question here is, will Lakeland be a city that remains stuck in the past, looking back, or is it a city looking towards a great future? Taking liberty to paraphrase the great speaker, Ronald Reagan, Mr. Wiggs, city commissioners, move that monument.
Thank you, Mr. Cade.
Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Brown. I do live here in Lakeland. Since this debate got started, it's been made to seem as though the Confederate monument in Munn Park climbs down and chases people out of the park and sets up roadblocks to stop businesses from moving in. Apparently, it stopped minorities and from eating in restaurants, not the hateful bigots in the restaurants, the statue. The monument stopped minorities from voting, not corrupt bigots. The monument stood in doorways, at fountains, and was in hundreds of different places, stopping minorities in Lakeland from enjoying their God-given rights, not the racists and bigots who installed white-only signs and other despicable things. From the way those who want to take it down portray it, the monument stopped people from enjoying their freedoms, accessing civil liberties, and just living peaceful daily lives. Apparently, nobody who wrote the laws or passed the Jim Crow legislation had anything to do with it. Bigots and working in high places had nothing to do with it. It was all the statue's fault. Then there's the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Far from the group of daughters, widows, wives, sisters, mothers, aunts, grandmothers, and others seeking to honor, mourn, and memorialize their fallen family members, they are tarred as racists bent on national campaign of intimidation. A campaign marked by fish fries, oyster bakes, fundraisers, and sponsored parades of both Union and Confederate veterans and Memorial Day flowers. The people of the 1800s and early 1900s didn't use cenotaphs for the dead to intimidate blacks and other minorities into not enjoying their God-given rights. They passed laws, they joined the KKK, and they did other things that were clearly and emphatically racist. Claims to the contrary, the United Daughters of the Confederacy and monuments to the dead are not among these. But that doesn't stop people from making these claims. It's easy to claim everybody is a Nazi or a racist or whatever when you don't have to present proof behind that claim. It's harder to discuss the complicated issues of history in a 3-minute speech when the majority often doesn't want to listen. I ask you to listen to the calmer, rational voices that have supported Mr. Troutman and Ms. Yates' proposal to add more monuments and more history in the historic district. After all, it is the historic district. What better place for history? And I also ask for protection of ordinances or protection ordinance for all monuments in Lakeland. And one other thing about poles. Even if you want to discard the Gravis pole, there's all those poles in the Lakeland Ledger, which is definitely not a friend to the monument and has continually tried to stir this pot. And it consistently shows a majority of Lakelanders in favor of keeping the monument. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Number 7.
My name's Ricky Shara, citizen of Lakeland. Thank each and every one of you for letting me speak today. I don't know how many of you were at First Friday this past Friday night, but it was packed, and I don't see the people there being offended whatsoever. It's been there 107 years, hasn't hurt anyone. It's just taken a few groups that just have hate and just want to keep it stirred up. I'm in favor of just keeping the monument where it's at for another 107 years. But, you know, You call Mon Park the centerpiece of Lakeland? Well, it is for now. But everything's going to change with Bonnet Springs coming on board. That's probably going to be the centerpiece in Lakeland later on. So that's how I feel. I do know that there's been some fear and intimidation involved in this whole deal. Two of the commissioners were threatened as far as the NAACP going to their house Friday and protesting, and that's just wrong, absolutely wrong. I have spoke to the mayor, I spoke to Mr. Walker. This is a fact. Why do you think there's such a law enforcement force here today? Because they're expecting things to get out of hand. But when they have to call and make and say, we're going to protest at your house, and Mr. Walker was out of town in fear of his family, and I can understand him feeling that way. He's not here. Luckily, when I spoke to him, he said it has been canceled at his house, and they canceled it, I guess, at Ms. Yates' house, because I checked, and they said, no, it's not going to happen. But I see that as fear and intimidation, and it's just absolutely wrong. Y'all don't mind spending $150,000 for a consultant, so why don't you put it to the vote for the citizens of Lakeland and let them decide what to do with the monument? And if they vote to get rid of it, break it up in 1,000 pieces, so be it. The people have spoken. But that's the way I see it. Our kick the can down the road. The new commission is going to take over at the first of the year. Let them handle it and see how they want to do it. With that being said, leave the monument alone. It hasn't hurt no one. Walked out of Silver Ring the other day with someone, asked them what they thought about the monument. They didn't even know what it was. So it hasn't bothered no one. So thank you very much for listening to me today.
Thank you, Mr. Shivert.
Mr. Mayor and Commissioners, thank you for letting me speak. My name is Larry Rankin, 35-year citizen here in Lakeland. There's a brief definition for racism. It's simply this: privilege plus intimidation and power is racism. This statue, I believe, needs to be removed and placed in a place where it can be put into historical perspective. And I'm going to repeat what all those who have spoken for the removal of the statue have already said. I'm going to be giving you two very personal anecdotes. Number one, my parents served in Cuba, pre-revolutionary Cuba, in the 50s and then early 60s. And at one point, my mother and I landed at Key West, having come over from Havana. And along the way on the Greyhound, we stopped in various places in the mid-50s. And I observed as a child two separate water fountains, two separate waiting rooms. One was white and the other one was labeled colored. And being that we were living, and as I knew only about Cuba as a child, because I was taken there at 2 years old, I asked my mother, what's going on? What is this colored and white? I was a 7-8 year old. And she had to give me the history of what segregation in this country was all about, even when there were other places around the world where this type of segregation and racism didn't exist, even though that is quite evident in other places. So I had my trial by fire, so to speak. I had my awakening of what was going on in my own country, even as I felt so proud to be back in the United States and honor the flag on its flagpole. The other anecdote I have is that 49 years ago, I was a student at Emory University in Atlanta, and I went to the public funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King, and I was there. And I was committed to become a social and a Christian activist for the sake of human rights and not only integration, but the rights of all our citizens in this country as Dr. King emulated and lived and died for. So I'm against maintaining the statue where it is. It needs to be removed and put into its proper historical perspective. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rankin.
Good morning, Commission. My name is Joe Gishwin. I live on the far south side. I'm for the statue remaining where it's at. It doesn't commemorate any one person. It commemorates all the Southern people who have died during this war. Most of them did not own slaves. Most of them were drafted into this Southern war. 620,000 or more died on both sides. And it just commemorates the dead, nobody else. Leave it where it is, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Geschwin. Janet, is it Finley?
My name is Janet Finley. I belong to a lot of organizations here in Lakeland, but I'm here as a citizen of Lakeland. When I came here 10 years ago, I go down Tumen Park, I've spent a lot of time there. Everything happens there. The Christmas lights, First Fridays, the Truck Thursday. And you go to Tumen Park and you don't see white people, you don't see black people, you see people. I see just as many white people as I do black people. Granted, I didn't notice the statue right away. But when I did, if you don't stand for something, you stand for nothing. I know what it means now, and it is offensive to me. It divides this city. The Confederacy was formed right after Lincoln was made president to preserve the state right and slavery. It was dedicated in 1910 by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. They lost the war. I don't need another flag. I don't need another prop. I'm an American citizen. And my Pledge of Allegiance is to one flag. They lost. Thank God. Alexander Stephens, in his cornerstone speech of 1961, is most remembered for his idea that white men were superior to black men. I've taken children from the church and the community to that park. I don't want them to remember that, to be oppressed with that. It needs to be moved to an appropriate location. I need something in the park. Well, my time is up, but that's how I feel about it.
Thanks, Ms. Finley.
That's Lakeland resident Janet Finley speaking this morning at a Lakeland City Commission meeting during public comment. They're talking about a controversial statue of a Confederate soldier in Tumen Park that the Lakeland City Commission is voting on today, of whether to keep the statue and add additional monuments in the park and the rest of the city. We also heard from Joe Geschwin, Larry Rankin, Ricky Shiver, Jeffrey Brown, Kevin Caton, David McAllister. What are your thoughts? Here's the number to call, 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. You're listening to Midpoint Monday. It's 12:55 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. Give us a call, 813-239-9663. I want to read an email that came in during that public comment. Herb in Tampa writes, can someone verify that David McAllister lives in Hillsborough County? Thought he lived in Wesley Chapel, making him a resident of Pasco County. Is that the case? Should he be allowed to comment at other county commissions? So I think it's open to anyone to talk at the county commission, for example, at Lakeland City Commission. But I looked up the public records, and there was a David McAllister that bought a house in Temple Terrace, but I didn't see any other David McAllisters in Hillsborough County. But if that's something that's important to you, you can look that up. The number to call is 813-239-9663. I also want to read some breaking news about former Congressmember Corrine Brown. This is from Jacksonville.com. She was sentenced today to 5 years in federal prison for fraud and tax crimes that included raising about $800,000 for a sham charity. Brown's longtime chief of staff, Ronnie Simmons, was sentenced to 48 months in prison, and the charity's founder, One Door for Education President Carla Wiley, was sentenced to 21 months. U.S. District Judge Timothy Corrigan said he believed Brown used her position in Congress to achieve an admirable record of service. However, he also said she abused the trust of that office in order to carry out a criminal conspiracy. In a long statement read before announcing the sentences, Judge Corrigan noted that the three each reaped the benefits of the illegal scheme, which he described as especially shameless. So that's former Congressmember Corrine Brown, sentenced today to 5 years in federal prison. And let's go to... is it Micheline in Lakeland, right? Hi, Micheline.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. What would you like to say?
I would like to say that I am from Lakeland, and I think that statue and Mon Park needs to be put at the bottom of the ocean. I think it's evil. Anybody who's anti-race, black, white, yellow, green, is a bad person.
And Micheline, do you think that your city commission is going to agree with you?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do, but I'm going to try to do my best to go. I'm going to go and...
You're listening. I can hear. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks for those thoughts. I'm going to go move on to someone else unless you have something else to add.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Micheline. And let's hear from Danny in Winter Haven. Hi, Danny.
Hey. Do these, you know, Confederates understand exactly what they were fighting for? I mean, the slave depot lynching. I mean, how many people were lynched? And, you know, they call it, well, they didn't own slaves. Well, if you are standing in the street and you're cheering these guys on, you are part of the pack. You are the same as those people. Plus, those people were fighting against the United States. They wasn't fighting for a United States. They were literally fighting over money, a couple of bucks. And I personally think it's because they were a bunch of lazy bums. Thank you.
All right, Danny, thanks for calling in. Let's hear from... Hi, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from? Caller, you're... Oh, we lost that person. Hi, caller. What's your name and where are you calling... Oh, hi. Hi, caller. Trying to put this caller on the air. I'm sorry. Oh, caller, we have you now. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Josh from Tampa.
Hi, Josh. What would you like to say?
So, hearing about the Confederacy statues, I would challenge folks to have a certain point of view, which is that a lot of especially liberal folks might make the argument in favor of saying, well, this is how we learn from history. You know, this is a part of our history. And if we learn from it, then we... which is, you know, an interesting point. But I would just challenge folks who hold that point of view to consider what we have done with other statues in other parts of the world. Namely, the first thing that comes to mind is Saddam Hussein's statue in Iraq and how much meaning we imbued into that act and what that meant to us as a country to pull down that statue. And so I just want folks to think about that, because while that was also historic, that Saddam Hussein reigned in that area, you know, we weren't really eager to keep that statue up after his power had been usurped or overcome. And so I just would challenge folks to consider that.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Josh. And thank you to everyone who called. We have Teresa on email who says, oh, my name is Terry. I agree with the statue being removed. The Confederacy lost. Time to heal. We have one flag. We are one nation. Peace and Merry Christmas. That's from Terry in cyberspace. And if you are on the line or you emailed and I didn't get to you yet, I'm sorry. I'm going to tell you how to reach out in the future. Thanks to everyone who called, emailed, and texted today. If you're still on hold, You can leave me a voicemail with your thoughts. That's 813-238-8001, extension 114. I'll play your message next show. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news or on Facebook or Twitter at WMNF News. Thanks to our engineer, Alvaro Montealegre. Thank you to our phone answerer, Frank Knox. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of WMNF News Midpoint Monday. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned right now for Craig Kopp and John Gilmore on Executive Session. That's coming up after NPR headlines. On WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland, thanks so much for listening.